And just so I don't sound like a total utility guy, I did start my career with the Iowa Consumer Advocate's Office and the Iowa Utilities Board. So I have a foot in both worlds, so that's a little bit of experience. What I thought I'd share with you today is a little bit, perhaps, of a utility's perspective looking at energy efficiency, particularly when they are faced with some kind of an emphasis to spend significant additional money on TSM. So I thought I'd share with you a little bit about how some utility executives react to some of those mandates, why they like TSM in some instances, why they don't like it, in others, or what could be done to help mitigate the tension that David was talking about earlier around how do you get aggressive new investment in energy efficiency activities. But we need the presentation. And if anybody wants to leave me a card, I'll be happy to send them on direct this year. So I thought I'd touch very quickly on the potential for DSM, not spend a lot of time drilling down on it, but share with you some thoughts on what the conventional wisdom has been on the cost effectiveness of DSM and the potential for DSM. Share with you a little bit about what some of the barriers to DSM planning are, focusing on primarily on regulatory relationships, and if we get time, I'm going to drill down into some of the alternative cost recovery mechanisms for DSM, separate from the decoupling issues that David was talking about. And then I'll share with you some of the what I think are the new complexities associated with looking at demand-side management programs, and how has it changed given that in many parts of the country we've seen a disintegration of the value chain associated with utility planning and the integration of emissions considerations and water considerations and a broader set of issues associated with DSM planning. So just as a quick baseline, I thought I'd share with you the results of a survey of about 18 different studies that have been done on the value for energy efficiency or on the potential for energy efficiency. And while there is, I think, enormous ranges of what people think a reasonable load impact of DSM has been, this suggests that of the studies that we looked at, about 10% of demand can be saved over 11% of demand over a 12-year period. That is, of the total demand out 12 years, you can peel off 10%. There are certainly studies that say you can save 20 or 30%. There are a few studies out there that think that we can actually be driving demand growth negative. But this suggests, I think, a representation of a reasonable range. It's certainly the case that DSM can be very inexpensive. The studies that we looked at and a lot of the results, for instance, the Texas programs, Texas spends about $80 million a year on DSM. Their programs come in at around $450 a kW, or conversely, around 1.5 to 2.5 cents a kilowatt hour. So certainly very, very, very cost-effective opportunities relative to the cost of generation at, $1,100 to $1,400 for a coal plant. And DSM could certainly sometimes provide significant economic development emissions and transmission and distribution benefits. I say sometimes, and we'll drill down into this a little bit more later, is that a lot of the intuitive expectations around what DSM may do for emissions are wrong. And I'll take you through some of that. But DSM does not necessarily improve your emissions profile. It does not necessarily improve your local economic development activities. And I'll take you through some of the reasons that I ask you about here in just a moment. Some of the barriers to DSM, and I alluded to this just a moment ago. The disintegration of the value chain, that is, parsing off generation as a competitive entity, parsing off the transmission construction into an RTO or an ISO, and then having the traditional entity who's responsible for DSM, the T&D utility, or the distribution utility, trying to plan as if it were a fully integrated system is common in many states. There are a lot of places still, even where generation has been deregulated, the distribution utility is required to invest and behave and plan as if they owned generation. So a lot of the T&D costs, a lot of the benefit cost ratios that are still used, still incorporate avoided generation costs as if they're a crude utility. Now, I'm not suggesting that you wouldn't want to do that from a societal perspective, and there are some interesting things to do, but it certainly gives the T&D utility some tension and some heartache when they're being asked to make investments that avoid somebody else's capital cost activity. The second point there seems to have been diminished somewhat over the past 10 years or so. It was certainly very, very much the case 10 years ago that utility system planners, particularly when they had the responsibility for meeting a reserve margin, were very skeptical of PSM load impacts, did not believe that they were dispatchable when they needed to be, did not believe they would be there on peak, believed that there were all kinds of free ridership issues. And so there was strong resistance of many utilities to doing PSM because they couldn't rely on it. They couldn't measure it the same way you can measure the output of a power plant. That seems to have diminished. You still run into that on some occasion, but for the most part, I think DSM as a science has done enough metering, it's got enough credibility in the industry now that is somewhat diminished. We'll talk more about cost recovery later, but in many jurisdictions, there's a strong tension between limited authority that the PUC may have to grant outside of rate case cost recovery, perhaps, or to set minimum goals, or to require changes in reliability standards, whatever the case may be. And a lot of that work has to be done through legislative sessions. In my home state, Texas, for example, the legislature only meets every 2 years. There's an awful lot going on there. To try to get the issue of energy efficiency to rise to the top is difficult. In Texas this year, it's going fairly well. There are proposals there to quintuple the DSM spending from $80 million to $500 million a year, and we'll see how successful those are. Talk a little bit about the method of cost recovery and rate impact here in a few minutes. Allocation and class equity issues. In many jurisdictions, the industrial groups have a very powerful voice, particularly at the legislative level. And I think the DSM industry as a whole has done a poor job of understanding industrial concerns about additional spending on DSM, and number one, characterizing the potential value of DSM to those large industrials, of working with those groups to understand different cost recovery and cost allocation mechanisms, and potential carve-outs and opt-in, opt-out programs. So I think the industry is getting better at reaching out to a broader range of participants and diminishing the sort of perhaps the knee-jerk reaction that many large consumers have to proposals for incremental DSM spending. Talk a little bit more about incentives. Many of the utilities that I have worked with over the years have very mixed feelings about incentives for demand-side management. For the most part, and I'm not for disclaiming, I'm not talking about any specific client at any specific time, not offering any of their direct opinions. But in general, they're not looking to get rich on incentives. They don't necessarily see it as a way to make any meaningful increment. And in almost every case that we've ever looked at, the amount of energy efficiency incentive, even at the top end of any of the range that we talk about, would still be earnings in the rounding in the earnings per share of utility holding companies. So for the most part, these are not truly significant in the context of financial performance for the utility. A few exceptions, but for the most part, that's the case. Given that, what they typically want to do is just get reasonable and timely cost recovery, perhaps get some capital expenditures, but for the most part, they just want to be made sure that they're kept whole and not penalized for doing energy efficiency, as opposed to expecting it to be a huge new growth engine for the holding company. We'll talk more about that later. And then the last issue is around trust and consistency. Many of the utilities that I've worked with over the years are extraordinarily skeptical of the stability of a DSM cost recovery regime, and perhaps some of that comes from the experience of 10 years ago as decoupling came in and out and shared savings mechanisms came in and out. But most of them are very reluctant to create any kind of a regulatory asset or a deferred account to collect their DSM spending until they get to the next rate case, because they're so with so many commissions being elected and with change in staff positions, it's a fairly risky proposition for a utility to have a large capital expenditure sitting out there waiting to get some kind of recovery treatment, which is why I think many of the utilities you'll see expensing all of their DSM expenditures, which is not a very profitable activity for them, but it's certainly a risk minimization activity. Something else that really kind of gets the utilities fired up tends to be goal setting. And goal setting is done in a very diverse fashion across the country. There are certainly places that say we're going to go out and spend 2% of utility annual gross revenues on DSM, and that's the goal. There are other places that will do very, very detailed bottoms-up market potential studies, and I'll start with that, some measure of what they feel the technical potential for energy efficiency may be, and scale that down to come up with an economic potential, and then perhaps do some more math to figure out what they feel market potential may be. But for the most part, the goal-setting process is, in my opinion, very arbitrary from a utility's perspective, and it really doesn't typically spend enough time and science building up what a reasonable goal for a utility should be and what a reasonable target should be. It's a lot of time it's looking at, you know, what somebody did in Connecticut or what somebody did in Texas or what the city of Austin may do or whatever the case may be. And for me and for many utilities, that's just not a very targeted discussion, and they've got some uncertainty and some risk associated with that. Many places put a restriction on what the utility program cost components can be. Many commissions have mandated, say, that utility non-incentive costs could be no more than 10% of the overall program budget or 25% of the program budget. And that's something that goes into rule really before the utilities have started much of their planning activity. That, again, I think, sends some very specific issues or signals to the utility about the kinds of programs that they could pursue, how they should deliver those programs, whether they should build internal capability or using contractors to do these kind of things. And setting, I think, de facto standards of what an administrative or a marketing cost should be is the wrong thing to do. The way to approach it is perhaps more looking at individual programs, the prudence and the design of those programs, and lots of opportunity there to make specific decisions around what the cost structure should be. But setting something in rule up front, I think, is somewhat limiting. The processes for a utility to file a DSM program, you know, go through the testimony process, get approval, implement it, come back and get MV on it, the whole life cycle of a DSM decision is extraordinarily long. And the way in which those decisions are rolled out, I think, is sometimes perhaps in inverse order of the way that you would do it if you were trying to encourage active utility participation. Let me give you a specific example. Utility out west filed a very comprehensive demand-side management integrated resource plan, requested for approval on five or six different programs, but also had a cost recovery proposal in it. All of the individual programs were reviewed, were put on the procedural schedule, and the last one to get put on the procedural schedule was the cost recovery proposal. So, you know, the utility was in the uncomfortable position of having, you know, five different DSM programs approved, but was unwilling to start work on any of them, although some of them were getting to be, you know, a year's past the approval date because the commission hadn't moved yet on the cost recovery proposal. And they felt the risk associated with communicating that problem to their analyst community. You know, had they gone ahead and spent the money, there was a lot of risk associated with that, and they were unwilling to do it. So it created a lot of tension, I thought. Perhaps with some better communication between the intervener groups and the utility and the commission, they could have set the priorities slightly differently. I mentioned this a little bit earlier. Let me add a little bit more detail. DSM does not necessarily improve your emissions profile. We're doing a lot of work recently looking at how DSM may change the generation build path. And in many cases, find that in deferring new plants, one of the basic tenets of the way you do energy efficiency, you're also deferring a plant that has a much better emissions profile than your existing plant. You're also perhaps deferring the date at which you could retire an existing plant that's got a bad emissions profile. You're deferring in service data. That new plant that probably has a much better heat rate is a much more efficient provider of energy. And so although you're avoiding the capital cost of that plant, you're also jacking up emissions, and you're also jacking up the average price of energy. You may be creating, depending on what your wholesale market looks like, a much tighter market for capacity, and wholesale prices rise. So that's not at all suggest that it's not a good thing to do DSM, but I think the level of rigor that many utilities are expecting to see around the DSM analysis is requiring the DSM planners to take into effect some of these kind of things and typically count them as offsets to the benefit of the DSM programs. The value of T&D is becoming a much more sophisticated element of DSM planning than it was many years ago. A typical number may be $100 to $150 a kW of incremental benefit. Well, it certainly varies by jurisdiction. And then the science associated with valuing demand response in many markets now. We have a real-time capacity market. How do you treat that in a DSM program? In many jurisdictions now, we have third-party providers who will come in and provide DR programs and share that value with the customer. Is that a service that's better provided by the utility? Does it belong in the competitive marketplace? How does that all play into a system planner's perspective on what the build went? Is an interesting complexity. It seemed like 10 years ago there were a lot of DSM planners out there, a lot of good end-use data, a lot of good market saturation surveys, some pretty sophisticated tools for looking at demand-side management and planning and integrated resource planning. A lot of that information has evaporated as the threat or the opportunity, depending on your perspective of retail competition, came through. A great many utilities disbanded the load research department, took away the marketing department, and haven't done a saturation study in 10 or 15 years. The ability to come up with good empirical engineering-based estimates of what your DSM programs are going to do is very limited. The availability of models to take that information and do something with it is much more limited. And quite frankly, the availability of staff to do that. The folks that were involved in the heyday have in many cases retired, and so we certainly, and I think a lot of our peers, have a very tough time finding people with some of the basic skills associated with calculating, a RIM test or a TRC test, and that used to be, every person you bumped into on the street knew how to do that. Now it's not so much the case. I'll pick it up here a little bit here. Let me touch base on one. Another factor that tends to enter the discussion much more so than it used to is the issue of beneficial electrification, which many advocates, including myself initially, tended to think, that's load building. But in many areas of the country, particularly those that are non-attainment areas for the 8-hour ozone standard, there's a strong push to look at electrification as a way to mitigate air quality standards. If you look at the NOx problems in many large metropolitan areas, it's in large part transportation-based. The opportunity to put electric vehicles in, electric lawnmowers, electric motors as opposed to natural gas engines on interstate gas transmission pipelines. There's a lot of opportunity to promote electricity that has very, very beneficial air quality emissions characteristics, but it's somehow perceived very much as being a load-building activity, and that tension, I think, needs to be understood and examined in the process. Let me touch very quickly on some of the alternatives to, and I apologize, this is rather a hard one to see, but on some of the alternatives to decoupling and how some utilities have reacted to it. Three or four basic issues that you need to address in any kind of comprehensive cost recovery proposal. Number one is, how are you going to treat cost recovery and the basic choices there? Are you going to expense it? Are you going to capitalize it? And as I mentioned earlier, capitalization, although it seems to make a lot of intuitive sense if you're spending money to build a generating plant, to avoid building a generating plant, it seems reasonable to take that same pot of money, amortize it over its useful life, give it a utility rate of return. And for a long time, that was a fairly popular way of doing things. My sense is that tends to be less attractive now. There's certainly jurisdictions to do it. but just the issues associated with, you know, what's the return on that rate base, what's the life of that rate base. As I mentioned earlier, having a regulatory asset hanging out there is not typically well received by many analysts. It's a bit of a problem. So a lot of folks are expensing it and then hoping to make up the value of the time value of money and be otherwise compensated by getting some kind of a little incentive associated with it. And in some cases, trying to get a great big incentive associated with it, to be entirely honest. But for the most part, it doesn't seem to be extraordinarily large. The opportunities for incentives, fairly common is a bonus or just a bounty for every dollar or for every megawatt or megawatt hour you get, there's some incentive that's paid to the utilities. More common, I think, sending better price signals is the concept of shared savings. Whatever your benefit cost test that you have to be using in the jurisdiction, how do you share those savings and provide the right signals to boost participation and minimize expenses. The problem is that tends to be a very administratively complex and contentious activity, so some folks tend to shy away from that. I see Mark about to rush me away from the podium. So I'll close that. If anybody wants to draw down on pros and cons of those, feel free to join me after the show.